Hello and welcome to Two Fat Expats, where we're all about packing as much into your expat life as you can. That's what we mean when we say fat, we mean full and overflowing. This expat podcast is listened to in over 160 countries, and we have a Facebook group with over 11,000 members. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie based in Qatar. And each week I'm joined by Nikki Moffat, who's also an Aussie, and she's in Hamburg, Germany. Together we have 12 locations between us, which is a lot of learning new words for please and thank you, beers for the movers, and magic boxes that haven't been opened for three countries or more but couldn't possibly be thrown away. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kirsty Rice. Guess what Facebook just told me?
Oh, what?
Today.
Yes.
Today is 15 years to the day since we took off from Sydney with a nine-month-old baby to live for 3 years in Hong Kong. And that really blows me away because, one, I probably wouldn't have remembered the date without Facebook's help.
Yeah.
Thank you, Facebook. Also, it seems just like yesterday in so many ways. I can just really remember it. But anyway, that's not here and now. That's 15 years ago. You are fresh off the plane back in Qatar with a high school graduate in the house and a new baby. It's all happening.
It is. The beautiful Helen, our housekeeper, had her baby a couple of days ago. His name is Fikur, which is love in Ethiopian. And he is the most divine thing you have ever seen in your life. But yes, I'm back. I'm back for a month. My daughter had her first exam today, so her first year 12 exam, one of 16 to come. And so, but God, it's good to be back. Now, Nikki, we're going to go and we're going to follow our usual format and break the podcast up into five topics, which are, of course,
geographically challenged, where we talk about the impact of having lived and loved in more than one place. We'll also cover expat relationships, and that can be anyone that you meet in your expat travels or your expat world.
We'll also look at expat tech, where we look at all of the latest tech available to expats, and expat money, where we discuss money issues that are particularly relevant to expats.
And location, 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 where we speak to an expat living somewhere in the world as an expat, and we ask them the fat five questions.
Okay, so geographically challenged. Nikki, you are geographically challenged. Why?
Well, Kirsty, thank you. I'm happy to have a soapbox for my rant. I was at Cookbook Club on the weekend, and it was pointed out to me that there was an online referendum that I didn't know about in Europe this year, and Europe voted by a massive majority to end daylight savings time.
We're not just saying Germany, we're saying all of Europe.
No, all of Europe.
Really?
All of Europe. And I went to look for the information. I couldn't find it, but someone did say to me, I think there were 4 million people that voted and 3 million were Germans, right. Which sounds about right. Because Germans don't apparently like daylight saving. Now, really? I lived for all my life thinking daylight saving was the business because I grew up in Australia. Then I lived for 9 years in countries without daylight saving. So when we lived in Hong Kong, no daylight saving. In South Africa, no daylight saving. And in South Africa particularly, it was annoying because you had beautiful summers. And yes, what would be better than a longer twilight into the summer evening? But no, dark at 8 o'clock, you know, just awful. Yeah. Anyway, then when I moved back to the States, I was thrilled to know that they had daylight savings. And here, I was even more thrilled because we're much further north than we've ever been.
Right.
And in summer, even with daylight saving, making the day longer, at 4:15, it's light in the morning. 4:15 in the morning, it's light.
Wow.
So if you end daylight savings time and you end it in wintertime, because this is the other debate that they're having, do we have wintertime time all year or do we have summertime time all year?
Oh.
Because when you think about it, what is the normal time?
Mm.
Is it the summertime or the wintertime? What is the normal time? And I've always thought, well, wintertime is a normal time because you have daylight saving for summer. But then I thought, well, that's not really right, is it?
Mm.
Summertime could be the problem. Anyway, do you have daylight saving in Qatar?
We do. Hold it. No. We don't because I only noticed daylight saving, and this is one of those geographical challenges because of the time changing in Australia, right? Because I suddenly have to get up an hour earlier for work, you know, or something changes, it's like, oh my God, that meeting that used to be at 7 a.m. is now at 6 a.m. or even worse, the meeting that was 6 is now at 5. And I think there is one stage where it was, you know, that meeting that was at 5 is now at 4. But we've corrected all of that. So no, we don't.
Here it is a big issue. One thing we have is that we have a regular time that we catch up when we record the podcast.
Yes.
And it was 9 o'clock at my time. For the last 6 weeks. This week it popped up at 8 o'clock. I thought, well, that's unfair. I'm missing an extra hour of prep time because we've gone back off from daylight saving. So now we're longer, we're actually an extra hour apart now than what we usually
are.
Yes,
yes.
So it is one of those things, because when you call different parts of the world, you can't just know what the time difference is. You have to factor in daylight savings, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I am fine to do that because I am a proponent of daylight saving and or summertime. So I have lived in different places and experienced both scenarios year round, and I am a big proponent for daylight saving. But I noticed I got into quite a few friendly disagreements.
Really?
On some social media groups where people, there was a particular Instagram account I follow, and it's in Southern Germany. It's a relocation account. And so, and someone wrote, you know, what do you, do you want daylight saving? Yes or no? I guess it must have been when the referendum was going on that I didn't know about. And everyone said no. And I said, who are you people and where are you from? And why don't you want daylight saving? And they all sort of jumped on me and said, well, why would you want it? I said, because I don't want the sun to come up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, I'll call it a hill I will die on. I want daylight saving and I want to live in places with daylight savings.
Now, you keep saying daylight savings. Is it savings? I know it as daylight saving.
You're correct. It is daylight saving. And I, before, when I wrote it down, I wrote daylight saving, but people do tend to speak about it as savings, but I do know the correct terminology is
savings. No, I'm with you. Look, I think daylight saving to me is summer. And it represents everything about summer, of that whole thing, because, you know, when, as Australians, when we go home in the winter, it's dark earlier and, you know, you've got the fire going and, you know, dinner on and whatever, and it's all early and kids are in bed on time. But I remember then we would go home for summer beach weather and you can still be down at the beach at 9 o'clock at night, and that to me is fantastic and how life should be throughout the summer. You should be able to be doing exactly that. That's what it's all about. But I think, yes, it's maybe something for our expats to think about, because I negotiated my hours of work with an Australian company during one phase, like it was in the October, and said, yes, I can start work at this time, because it worked out to be about, you know, 6 a.m. But, of course, then daylight saving came and it was 5 a.m. that I started work, and it was like, oh, my God. You know, that was just kind of pushing it that little bit further. So, yeah, it is something, Nikki, a very good point. If you've not lived in a world of daylight saving, you would not understand and it would make no sense to you at all.
And I also think it's a cultural touchstone, as you say, you know, going to the beach, the long summer days, the long summer nights. You know, sitting outside when it's warm because there's a little bit of twilight. I mean, that's all part of, you know, the first 30 years of my life. So I think that that's why it's important to me. Whereas I can understand if people grew up without it, it would be just as unimportant to them. So I get that people have different viewpoints, but I'm sticking with mine.
Go for it. Okay, so if you are someone that has had daylight saving, or you are someone that cannot stand daylight saving, leave us a message. And if you want to do that, head over to our website, twofatexpats.com, and click on the microphone and you can leave us a message and tell us all about it.
Expat relationships, Kirsty.
Yes.
What have you got to tell us this week?
Well, I have an interesting thing with relationships, and I think it's a good story of my eldest had her graduation this last week, which was beautiful. And
congratulations on your graduation.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I really liked the way the school did it. You know, we'd previously, you know, here she'd been in a big American school, and I've been to graduations here, which are lots of, you know, pomp and ceremony, aren't they? Dun, 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 dun. And because it's a massive school, everyone gets handed their certificate and shunted off the stage and whatever, and it really just the high achievers get their moment in the sun, you know, and everybody else throws their hat in the air and goes home. Because she was at a smaller school, they were able to, as each girl came up to the stage, they then told you a story about that young woman. So how long they'd been at the school, what sort of sports they'd played, what they'd enjoyed, what they were hoping to do in the future. Do you know, it was really very personal. And each house leader talked of each student. So it really did feel like you got personal touch, and I thought that was beautiful. So I noticed a lot of the other schools, because, of course, you know, all these things happen at the same time, so you can't help but compare what your friends' kids are doing for their farewell and what it looks like. And once again, culturally, that massive difference of I caught up with a girlfriend, dinners were big, right, where the parents go for the dinner and the kids go for the dinner, and they would have them at, you know, this lovely big hall or somewhere. It was really quite the event. And there was alcohol, you know, but for both, for everybody. Do you know, if you were 18 and you weren't in your uniform and whatever, you were allowed to. And in one of them, the parents had an after party at a pub upstairs, you know, to really, and it was a real celebration for the parents of, we've made it. Do you know, we got through this together and we've made it. And I wonder, is that too, that thing of, you know, if you're expats and you're on the move, things are far more transient. So, you know, my daughter goes to school with some girls who have been at school together, you know, since grade one, and then many more came in high school. But it's a whole different feel, I think, for the parents with those traditions. But anyway, off track, her graduation, we ended up with our very good family friends, John and Sally, who live in the beach house next to us and we're very close with. They came along for the graduation, and my other daughter, of course, was there, but my husband wasn't able to be there because he was back here with, you know, our two boys who are still here. So I guess that was different, but also I thought it was interesting, you know, probably if she would have graduated away from home, I would have thought in my mind, oh, well, my parents would be there and, you know, maybe my sister would be there, or, you know, that geez, you know, sister or brother would be there. But, of course, it's not in reality. It's not always like that, you know. My parents had commitments as well. They live a good 4-hour drive away. It was on a Friday night, so it didn't really sort of work. So I just thought it was interesting, you know, once again, it's that thing of when you're away from home, you kind of think things would be a certain way if you're at home. And then it's interesting when you are home that maybe they're not what you thought they were going to be anyway.
Yeah, that is interesting. And because you always have this idea, this sort of, you know, sun-filled rainbows and unicorns idea of, well, if we were at home in our home country, this is how it would work. But that's, as you say, it's actually not how it works.
Yeah. Nikki, do you have any idea of where your children will graduate? Is that something that still feels too far away?
Well, no, because I've got a grade 10 child, so I need to consider that. But at the moment is our intention that he will graduate here in Germany. Mm-hmm. In Hamburg at the school he's at. And in the next sort of couple of months, we need to make the decision about whether he will do that through the DP, the diploma program for IB, or whether he'll do that through the CP, which is the career program for IB.
So, Nikki, reviews.
Okay, here is a lovely review on iTunes, US iTunes, from Olare. The review said, when living overseas as expats and you might be feeling lonely or lost, these guys are a beacon of light and hope. They have fantastic advice along with a few laughs.
Oh, thank you.
That is just lovely.
Okay, so if you would like to leave us a review, head on over to iTunes or look in your podcast app. We love reviews. We desperately need reviews because they're what helps people find us. So, yes, if you've got a minute, head on over and leave us a review. Technically expat. So, Nikki, last week we were talking about working remotely, and you've just started a new role where you've been working for somebody, and you obviously have to bill them for their time. And you mentioned that you were using a program. Was it called HubSpot?
It is, yes, it's called HubSpot. So I'm working for someone who has other employees globally, and this is the program that they use to track the time and to pay their employees.
And what sort of work are their employees doing that they sort of track it? Are we talking PAs, or are we talking customer service, or what type of work?
I guess a little bit of everything. So the person that I'm working for has a couple of businesses. One of them is a styling business. So she employs a stylist, and she employs a VA, an online VA, and I think a customer service person. And then I'm working in another part of her business where I'm helping her with her podcast, doing editing and some marketing stuff for that.
Okay. Yeah, no. So with the tracking tool, is it handy for not only – do you feel like it's just as much for you as it is for them, or is it something that they – require from all their staff, that they all use this tracking tool?
Well, I guess it is. We had a discussion at the beginning, you know, we had several sort of Skype meetings where we talked about it, and she just gave me the information and said, here's the tool that we use. Here's, you know, I'll send you a link, and then you make your own account. You put in the details of how you want to be paid. So this tool pays you in two ways. You can either be paid through PayPal or through TransferWise.
Right.
So it's basically the payroll tool. So, but it's a combination of payroll and time tracking tool. So I have never had a conversation with the person about, well, how do you want me to use it? Do you want me to just to write in what I do, my hours, or do you want me to use it every time I go online? Yeah. And so you can see everything I do, because the tool can see a very deep level of detail in what you're doing. So if you turn it on when you start working, it will track things like, as I mentioned, it takes screenshots from time to time. It tracks the URLs, it tracks the apps that you use on your computer. So at the end of the time, when you turn it off, you can go in and see what did I actually do. So it'll say, you know, you were on WhatsApp for 3 minutes out of this 2 hour period. So I think, okay, well, that's fair enough, you know, that kind of stuff. Or you're on, you know, Chrome for X minutes, et cetera. And, you know, when I'm in my editing apps for the podcast, it will show, you know, you use this app for X amount of minutes. So it really does give a very detailed breakdown. Now, I understand that that can be seen in two ways.
Yes.
One, it can be seen in that it's incredibly intrusive. So this is my computer, my time, my house, and I am... But then I'm also working for this person. So until we build a relationship where we understand how each other works and how it all comes together, I don't have an issue with that kind of information being shared while I'm working.
Yeah.
I don't always remember to turn it on. And sometimes I go back in and say, oh, I did an hour of this, or I did 15 minutes of that, et cetera, et cetera. So, but, you know, we're a few weeks down the track, and we haven't had a follow-up conversation about it. If I felt particularly uncomfortable about it recording everything, I'd be quite happy to say, you know, I want to use the app because I know it's how you pay people. I prefer to just put my time in and log it that way. Do you have any issues with that?
Yeah.
As it is, it's probably 60-40 in terms of I use it 60% of the time, as in it's turned on, and then 40% of the time I'll go in and say, you know, I did this for an hour, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, you know, And I guess if there's an issue with that, then she'd come and talk to me about
it. Yeah.
Because that's what you do. So
I think this could be a fantastic thing for expats who own businesses, though, couldn't it? Because
absolutely.
If you want to employ a designer to do your website or someone, and you're working on an hourly rate, well, then that's a really great way of them to show, see, this is how I did it. Or, you know, or whether you know, it makes you change the rules entirely where you go, oh, shit, I didn't realise that was going to take this long. Now we need to talk about maybe we'll do X for X. But when you were saying about getting paid, the system I used to work is something called Xero, X-E-R-O, and that's just putting in timesheets and things. But I have seen now that Xero is starting to partner with lots of other apps where you can put your expenses in and all sorts of other things in. So Our remote workforce is really changing on a daily basis, isn't it, with the
yes,
with technology of what it can have. Now, I wanted to ask you, because you said it pays you with either TransferWise or PayPal. And one of my issues with PayPal, I have a PayPal account and I love it and use it, but I never use it for cash. Like, it's almost like I go back to this old-fashioned bartering way of that I get the money in my PayPal account and then I'll use it to pay for other things with PayPal, but I don't ever really take
it. You don't move it to you.
Yes, I don't move it to my bank because it does feel like there's some pretty hefty fees. Like, I know, Nikki, you know, when we've had two Fat Expat events and we've had to refund people, I've always ended up being massively out of pocket, you know, because there's some really hefty fees with refunds. What's it like, or did you just choose TransferWise when you chose for salary?
Yeah, that's a good point. So PayPal does have a 3% transfer fee. So, and you get charged 3% of the money, so you don't ever see that money. TransferWise doesn't have those same fees. And TransferWise also has borderless bank accounts. So I have applied for a TransferWise debit card. I haven't applied. They offered it to me.
Yes.
And so I'll be receiving a TransferWise debit card, and then I can move that money from my TransferWise account to another bank account in the world, or I can just say, this is my TransferWise account, this is my TransferWise debit, yes, and I'll just be using this special money.
Yes.
Special secret money.
If I'm going to break this up into pros and cons, what are the pros of using HubSpot?
Well, I think that the pros is that it tracks your hours and it has the ability when you're new in a relationship to have detailed tracking. And it also sends money weekly. So it just sends you a report and says, here's your money. I'm sure to the employer it says, yeah, exactly. In terms of the cons, I think tracking detailed things on your computer, I think that can be an issue and concern to people both ways. And also you could technically just throw your hours in there and then, you know, how does that work?
Yeah.
In terms of tracking, yeah. So if you're tracking the wrong hours. But I guess the other thing is that when you work with someone, you have to build a relationship and a level of trust. And also they have to have an appreciation of, well, if she said she's worked 4 hours and this is what she's completed, does that seem reasonable to me? So.
Yeah. And I can also see too, if there's a particular, you know, there are certain jobs, because I do lots of different things at work, and there are certain jobs I do that because I'm not in an office with some people around me, I think, oh my God, this takes so long. And I don't think people realize how long it takes to do this. You know, like I find transcribing SpeakPipe really a laborious task, right? Because you're going to sit there and listen and stop and redo and start and retype and whatever to get it all right.
And I've got an app for you.
Yeah,
for that.
There is, but it never gets it quite right either. Do you find that? Yes, like it yes. just doesn't get it exactly right, because we transcribe at work lots and lots of audio. But I think, you know, something like HubSpot, that would be a great way of someone going, wow, she really was just sitting there for 7 hours doing that. You know, that was a long time. So I could see that. Has there been many sort of discussions about it in your sort of online groups of people that work like you?
Well, there are. And I went sort of looking for them when I thought, gosh, this is quite full on in terms of everything it tracks about
yeah.
me. So I was just thought, oh, I'll just have a look in some of the online groups that I belong to about working remotely, online work, etc. And there was just one last week where someone wrote in a group, I'm thinking of not paying my VA because I don't agree with the work that's being done in the time that she's submitted. And so it created this massive discussion about, well, you've created this employee, you've created this relationship, what you do is you pay them and then you move on and find someone who will do the work in the time frame that you think is appropriate. You don't not pay someone for work they've done, which is the first thing that I think we can all agree on. The second thing was then it went down this track of talking about, well, you know, there are apps that can track when someone's working, when they're not working. You can see whether it's just someone that struggles with a particular task or whether, you know, they are, you know, having you on yeah. in terms of the amount of time yeah. they're spending. And there was a lot of different opinions about it. You know, there were people saying, you know, I consider myself sort of a slashy contractor. So I'm contracting my services to this lady's business.
Yeah.
And they said, well, if you're a contractor and you're running your own business, you don't submit that to them. You just say, these are my hours. You pay me for these. And I see the argument for that. And then there were people saying things like, well, if they have access to that, you know, you don't know what happens to HubSpot, you know, not HubSpot, but other particular tracking things. You don't know what happens. There could be viruses.
Yeah.
How safe are they? That's another argument. So I think there are pros and cons for everything. And there's a lot of sides to the argument. And there are probably people listening to this discussion now with different viewpoints as well that they could add to the conversation. But I just think in terms of building a relationship and the way that it's working for me now is fine. If, for example, I'd started working and the person said to me, well, you know, you've put in this time and I don't see anything for it. I'm not really happy. You're going to have to use it every single second of the day. You know, maybe that's not a person I'm going to be able to work with long term because that's not the way I work, or, you know, I'm doing the work. It's just that I don't want to feel that I'm being watched even remotely, you know, every second of the time I'm doing it. So, you know, it has pros and cons and it has a lot of different opinions online. And I think, you know, it's something that, you know, you could have a glass of wine with a few people and talk about extensively.
Well, speaking about that, having an opinion online and glasses of wine and talking to other people, have you joined our Two Fat Expats Facebook group? We've got over 11,000 members in there now, and you can discuss anything expat within the group with all of our amazing members. We have people in there from Sri Lanka to South Sudan. Nikki, expat money. I was going to talk about something going on in our lives at the moment. So having the child who's graduating, it means she is going to leave the boarding house within the next few weeks, which means she will be homeless. But she won't be entirely homeless because, as you know, we've got a house down at the beach and we'll have our summer holidays over December, January, or she will hopefully start university in the new years. So we plan for all of our kids to have summer jobs down at the beach over that break. But then as they go back into the real world, we are going to buy a little tiny, tiny, tiny two-bedroom apartment for our daughter and for us. The way that we were looking at this from a money point of view is our options were to go into residential living, which a lot of universities have residential living, or there are organizations that have residential living for people that go to many different universities. We don't, and I should point out, if there's any Americans listening, we don't do uni in the same way that probably Americans do uni, in that, you know, unis don't have their own housing, so that's not an option. But also we have a child who's just done 3 years in the boarding house, so has said that residential living is not for her, that's not what she wants to do. So we then looked at how much we would have to fork out for rent if she was to rent, you know, with a couple of friends in a share house. And we really, once we did the math of we had four children in 6 years, so we're going to have that same thing of four kids eventually, you know, so we'll go through university and study. So we thought, right, we will invest in a little unit in town. So I wanted to talk about today because this morning I have been on the phone, my husband and I were both on the phone to our mortgage broker to say, okay, how much money can we, you know, borrow before we're not destitute on the street? And we talked about getting a pre-approved loan. And a pre-approved loan is nothing more than just a computer-generated yes or no to let the real estate agent know that you're likely to be approved for the amount that you're borrowing. But I just thought it might be interesting to sort of cover pre-approved loans and why they're probably really handy for expats to do. Now, Nikki, have you had to get a pre-approved loan before in any of your moves?
I think, yeah, that's what we did when we moved to the US. So we looked at renting versus buying, and we saw that buying was probably a good option at the time. Let's stick with at the time. And so we spoke through some banks, and in the US it's quite tricky if you don't have a credit score or credit rating. So we spoke through that trusty international banking establishment, HSBC, and they gave us, sometimes they're the only option, and they gave, and we submitted our paperwork, and they said, okay, if you want to buy, you know, you want to buy a house up to this amount, we'll lend you this amount of money. Mm. And yeah, so, and then, so when we went for our look-see and we went with a real estate agent around to look at houses, we had an understanding of what kind of house we could buy.
Yeah. So I guess pre-approvals also provide you with sort of increased negotiating power as well when it comes to real estate agents, because they know that you've got sort of a few steps through the process. You know, interesting you mentioned HSBC, Nikki. We, when we bought our beach house, could not use HSBC because our beach house was 45 minutes out of the city, and HSBC in Australia didn't lend money to people that were building out of the city.
Interesting. Well, yeah. Worked for us.
Yeah. Well, you were in the city. Yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, sometimes that's that whole thing about being an expat, isn't it? Sometimes you think, well, I've got money in the bank and we're both earning good living and we're both doing well. And then you can go to your bank and your government says, well, actually, we're not really into giving money to expats. We don't trust them. So it's always good to find out what your options are. So what would you need for a pre-approval? You'll need evidence of your income and your pay slips, also of your savings, also of your current debts, credit cards, personal loans, and any other home loans, and then all your usual identification documents, e.g. your driver's license, passport, etc. So just if anyone else is about to venture into the world of home buying, I would thoroughly suggest go and get the pre-approved loan done first, because if you're overseas and you need to do something quickly, it would be great to get all that stuff done and dusted before you even start. So for us, it's a matter of getting all this done in the next few weeks, and then we know that if we want to go to an auction and have someone bid on our behalf, or we want to buy something quickly, it's all pretty much, you know, three quarters of the way done. So that was my little expat money thing for the week. Nikki, you spoke to someone in Nairobi, is that right?
I did. That's very exciting. So, and this week we're up to N. Can you believe we are more than halfway through the alphabet, Kirsty?
What are we going to do when we've gone all the way through?
So N is for Nairobi. So I spoke this week to Tanya. Tanya's originally from Ottawa in Canada, but she lived for 20 years of her life in St. Lucia, where her husband is from. And she's been in Nairobi for the last 3 years. Her husband works for a division of the UN there that deals in plastics pollution in the ocean and wastewater runoff and very important things like that. And her family is geographically split, Kirsty, just like yours. She has two sons in Canada, one at university and one who's working as a journalist. So do you want to have a listen?
Yeah, I'm going to have a listen right now.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your current level of in love with Nairobi?
Well, I'd say an 8. I mean, it's a beautiful, you know, it's a cosmopolitan city, but there's always the issue of safety and security. It's always in the back of your mind, you know. There's always this sort of underlying threat of terrorism and, you know, terrorist attack or even robberies. And they call it, the nickname for Nairobi, I don't know if you know this, is Nairobbery. you always have to be aware of your surroundings and sort of stay away from certain areas of Nairobi, and unless you go with, you know, a driver who's familiar with the surroundings.
Have you ever had an incident happen to you or a member of your family?
Well, nothing serious. I mean, we were coming off the highway near the central business district, and unfortunately, my husband took a wrong turn, and we ended up in this really congested part of the downtown area with matatus, you know, the minibuses, and mm-hmm. It was just jam bumper to bumper. And so while we were stuck, a guy came up to my husband's side of the window and he ripped the mirror, the side view mirror, off and just took off. This is very common. You'll see, if you're ever in Nairobi, you'll see a lot of vehicles with their vehicle number either etched or painted onto the different parts of the vehicle so that they can be traceable if they ever get stolen. So unfortunately, we stuck out like a sore thumb because we have, you know, the UN plates and...
And both your rear vision mirrors.
Just the one, just on the driver's side.
But you did have two. That made you stick out as well.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
What's your best local find?
Oh, there's so many really nice restaurants, and I just love the markets. They have like a weekly, what they call the Maasai market, where you can get all kinds of local crafts, souvenirs and crafts and just beautiful stuff. I'm just blown away by, you know, the talent and the workmanship here. You know, there's just so many beautiful crafts and local, you know, handicrafts. And yeah, so I'm working my way up, amassing a little collection here of Kenyan crafts and handicrafts. So
what drives you crazy?
Oh, the roads. Roads are just horrendous. Even out in the we live in a nice, relatively nice suburban area. For the last, actually, almost 3 years that we've been here, they've been doing this major new road construction, building a new major highway, right, that's connecting the southern end of Nairobi to the northern end up where we live. And that's the road that we happen to take to my daughter's school. So it's just been a nightmare driving to and from school every day because the roads are just, yeah, you know, we go from dirt road to, you know, gravel road and potholes, and it's just really a nightmare navigating some of these roads.
It's so funny because we're up to N in the alphabet. So we've done A through to N, and I can't think of somewhere where roads or traffic have not been the thing that drives people crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
What's one place you'd love to live in the world?
Oh, boy. I would love to live somewhere in the Far East, maybe Thailand. My husband did talk about the possibility of living there because they have UN offices. So I've heard a lot of nice things about Bangkok, Thailand, and I've never been to that part of the world. So that would be at the top of my list.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given about being an expat, living an expat life?
I guess, yeah. I mean, you can pretty much get anything here that you need, but it's really, I guess the cost factor is always a factor. So I would say bring like as much of the things that you're used to from wherever, you know, your home base, especially things for the kids, you know, for school things like school equipment or school supplies and things like that. Just bring a good stash of that because it's sometimes it can be tricky to get. You may have to go to 10 different places to get what you need. And it's, yeah, like I said, the cost of living is a little high here. So when I go back to Canada, I try to stock up on things that you can't readily get here. And yeah, so.
And what's the biggest lesson that you've learned?
The biggest lesson? Oh, I guess just take things one day at a time, you know, and keep a good sense of humor because things, you know, things are not always going to go your way. And yeah, and you know, it's a very transient lifestyle. I've come to learn that, you know, being new at this expat type of life. So, you know, try to keep a good circle of friends and friends that you can stay in touch with long after you leave, you know, your posting. And yeah, I think it's really important to have close, good friends.
Oh, she's beautiful, isn't she? Like, very soothing voice to listen to.
I know. And whenever I listen to people that speak in such a calm, measured tone, I always think, oh my God, I'm almost talking too fast. But
and with that lovely Canadian lilt. Nairobbery, I had not heard that before. That's very funny. But also you could hear in her voice too that, you know, the issue with the side mirror that got pulled off. You know, there's that thing that you laugh about, those things that happen. You know that everything was all okay, but that little flicker of an instant where you're not quite sure what's going to happen next.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've been in a situation like that where you're in downtown traffic and there's people just walking all around your car and you can't walk, you can't drive forward. And it's just it's a feeling. It's a very disconcerting feeling.
I was caught in a demonstration in Jakarta where hundreds of guys in, you know, what looked like karate suits almost, were like jumping all over the car and hitting the car with sticks. And I had I think she would have been 3-month-old baby in the back seat of the car with me. And yeah, just that, I think I'm okay. I think this is all for show. I think this is all okay. But oh my God, I'm just trying to stay really calm right now. Yeah, it's just the weirdest feeling, isn't it? Okay, Nikki, moving right along. What are you reading at the moment?
Reading? Well, thanks for asking, Kirsty. I am reading a book.
Wow. What encouraged this behavior?
Well, I went to school and I decided I was going to take up a new course, and I thought I'm going to look into this and what I need to.
When you say you went to school, you mean you went to your children's school? Yeah.
I went to my children's school for a meeting, and I was concerned that perhaps they weren't taking a particular thing seriously enough. So I thought, I'm going to go and research that, and I'm going to come back to the school with some ideas or offer to help sort of rework what they're doing right now. So I'm reading a book called Safe Passage: How Mobility Affects People and What International Schools Should Do About It.
Now, what was the particular thing that set you off? Like, what was there something where you thought, I don't think they're considering, what was it? I know it's hard to talk about things within your school,
your entire
community. So what did you feel was it something you thought was being overlooked, or?
Well, yeah, so it's transitions. So I think that the way the school deals with transitions is good. They've got a very good attitude about it, but I think they could possibly be being more support for the students. I actually think there's good support for the families, right, the way we're set up. So on your way in, there's great support. But I think that, so I went to a grade 10 coffee morning with the principal, and one of the questions I wanted to ask was, because we have quite a large contingent of new kids in the grade this year, there's about 17 new students in a grade of 70 kids. So that's quite a high percentage of new students. And I asked, I said, what support services do the, and the counsellors came and spoke and talked about how 10th grade was an extremely difficult year for many reasons. And so I said, in terms of the new students at the school, what support do you offer to new students, and how is that managed? And they said, well, they used to do small group sort of support things, so that they would offer them small group support at lunchtimes, and they'd sort of for the first few weeks of school have things where they talked about moving and whatever. But they've backed off on that because they don't think that was working particularly well. The students didn't like being involved. So now they just have an open door policy. So just come in if you need something. And I just wondered whether that was the right way to do it. And it felt to me like that might be a bit hit and miss. You might miss some things. And there might be some students that, and this is not a criticism of the school, because they're talking about what's worked and what hasn't worked in the past. And the other thing is that they've only had one counsellor for the whole senior school, which has been quite a busy job, I imagine. So this year they've got an extra counsellor who sort of sits across the middle school and the senior school. And I thought, well, maybe now is a time that they could consider or reconsider what they're doing and seeing whether that would be better to change. Mm-hmm. What is best practice?
Yeah.
What is globally accepted best practice for transitioning students, and how close are we to that?
Right.
And that's what I wanted to know.
And what has the book taught you so far?
Well, so far I've only read, do you know what? I'm doing my 30 minutes reading a day, and I'm reading every word. I'm a bit of a scanner, like just scan, move on. And I thought, no, I want to make notes. I want to use post-its. I want to be very clear with what's happening.
So I've been reading sort of coming to that. Good for you. I'm really impressed, Nikki. Like, this is what we should all do. I mean, I do the opposite. I do the whole, you're all a bunch of idiots and I'm not coming back again, do you know? But I think that's what you're doing is really good. So what have you learned?
Well, so what I've learned is, so the book is written by a guy called Doug Otter, and he worked for 17 years at the American School of The Hague, Den Haag, and he was a school counselor, and he's a psychologist and has a practice, and he also runs an organization called Safe Passage Across Networks that goes into schools and does consulting.
Right.
So, but basically there was a study done. So I've read the sort of foreword, the introduction and the foreword and all that part of it. And there was the study done that said the largest study in educational research history demonstrates that moving harms learning. So if moving harms learning, what do you do about that? Because as an international community of expats, we move.
Yeah.
So, and, but one of the things we also do is we expect our schools to teach our children to very high standards.
Yes.
So how can that be looked at and how can that work? And so he's talked about that he's tried to write this book several times. So he started with three different sort of ideas and approaches and none of them really worked because of how complex the situation is. And in the foreword, he lists hundreds of people, hundreds of students, hundreds of staff members, hundreds of parents, and just talks about how he really thanks them all because over this long, long period of time, he's come and written this book.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've talked about is that, you know, you have to say a clear goodbye in order to say a good hello. So we've talked about leaving well and how that's really important. And when I started looking into this just online before I bought the book, people were telling me about schools that they've had where they have, before school ends and kids are going to leave, they have lunch bunch groups there and talk about what that's going to be like to leave and move. Because it's true, to arrive at a new place, if you haven't left the last place properly, which we've talked about before, it's really difficult to move on. Anyway, this is what I'm learning. I'm learning sort of the background of it. But one of the things I would say is that the book has, at the beginning it says, it's got how to read this book. So if you don't want to read every word and highlight and make notes as I'm doing with post-it notes, you can, you know, if you want to do this thing, then read these chapters. If you want to do this, then read this part. So I think it's really good. So it gives you a practical guide. So if you're picking it up to look at something in particular.
Nisha, can I make a suggestion? Please, please, please. Can we do, because we could almost break down chapters of this. I was going to say, I would like to know, because I have a son who is going to leave his very lovely high five American school in 6 to 8 weeks, where he's about to go to a school where I spoke to their uniform shop, which is all going to be new to him for a start. He's never, hasn't worn a uniform since, God, for 9 years. I spoke to the uniform shop and said, hey, I'm just going to get the iron on name tags. And they said, no, you're not. We don't do iron-on name tags here. You will be sewing those name tags on over the Christmas break. And I knew by the tone in that woman's voice that she was right. I was going to be sewing them on. There was no discussion. And I just can feel that that's the way that this is going. But I was going to say, I would love it if we could do how to leave as either a relationships or a challenge next week in the podcast. And could we break down a few of those?
All right. Well, that's what I'll come back to you back with next week then. So, but I'm just telling you that I'm getting right into it and I'm enjoying it and I'm probably going to be sharing the wisdom because I think I'm going to be an expert by the time I finish the book. I'll be an expert in ideas anyway.
Okay, Nikki Telly, Amazon Prime. Now, I have seen the icon up on my Apple TV that I can click on Amazon Prime. I never have, but do you need an account for Amazon Prime? Is that how it works? What is it? I actually don't know how it works.
Well, I have Amazon Prime accounts. I have an Amazon Prime account in the US still and one in Germany. And I have watched lots of amazing videos and content on Amazon Prime and I really enjoy it.
And do you pay for it, obviously?
No, it's just part of your Amazon Prime membership. So you pay and it's part of having your deliveries for free under Prime and all that kind of stuff. And part of that is you also get access to content, video content like this.
Okay, so on the plane on the way back yesterday, I watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is set in the 1950s, and it was made by Amazon Prime, and it's about Midge Maisel, who has everything she ever wanted. She lives in New York and, you know, the Upper West Side, and she's got this lovely husband, and he works by day in the office but wants to be a comedian by night. And then her whole world sort of falls apart. And it's very pretty viewing, kind of very Mad Men viewing to look at, like aesthetically. And it also is, you know, one of those things when you go back to the 1950s and you suddenly have a rude awakening of what life was like for women. But I managed 3 episodes on the plane and I want to say they were about an hour each. And it was good. It's made me consider getting an Amazon Prime account just so I can watch the rest of it. I thought it was good. What about you? What have you been watching?
Well, just before we go on, I just have to make a clarification there. I don't want people yelling saying, you're wrong, you're wrong. When you have an Amazon Prime membership, you have access to a certain amount of Amazon Prime products and videos. But Amazon Prime is a video content is also like Apple TV in that some of it comes for free with your membership and some of it you can buy and pay for episodes as you go. Okay. So I just want to make that very clear.
Okay.
But when they make a series for the network, then it comes as part of your Prime membership.
No, I'm not overly keen for signing up for yet another subscription. Do you know what I mean? I feel like when I look through my bank statements of the little hits that I get from my iTunes account from newspaper subscriptions and, you know, a sneaky little $10 a month from Stan and then a sneaky little $12 from Netflix and a sneaky little, you know, it just appears that suddenly like, oh my gosh, I'm paying a lot of money for TV and I've done it without even thinking, and unless I'm really looking, I don't notice.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And if I didn't use Amazon Prime to have things delivered all over the world to me here at my apartment, I probably wouldn't have it as an additional place. But and I don't ever pay for anything. I just go and look at the free stuff.
So tell me, what are you watching?
I'm watching A Million Little Things.
I've seen this advertised. It looks good. It was advertised in Australia when I was home.
Oh, yeah. Was it? I saw it touted as the new This Is Us in one review I read. So I'm not going quite there.
Definitely yet. Looks like that from the outside. You know, it's got that similar sort of look to it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the premise is, you know, friendship isn't a big thing. It's a million little things. And in the opening scene, you see the four male leads of the show doing their thing. One's in his office, one's in his house, but the guy in his house is taking what looks to be an overdose. So he's got all sorts of pills and he just puts them all in his mouth and then he goes to take them and there's no water. He has to get some water. And while he's getting water, the phone rings and he hangs it up and then the phone rings again. He answers it. And it's one of his friends to say that one of the other group of four has committed suicide by jumping off a building. And it's no surprise because that's the premise the show is based on. But so the guy spits all the pills out and thinks, okay, I'm gonna be involved in my life again. But the fact is that guy is a videographer. So the person that's committed suicide that you never really get to know in the first episode is still in the TV series. So they show a lot of things in a series of flashbacks / videos that he's recorded.
Right. Brilliant.
I can't tell where it's going. There's affairs and there's all sorts of things. It's more an adult show. There's kids because they're family and they're, you know, in people in their mid-30s to mid-40s. So there are children in the show, but they're not really big part of the storyline yet. So I can't tell, but it's just a good sort of turn off, just, oh, what am I going to watch for the hour before I go to bed to switch my mind off? I'd recommend it from that point of view.
Ooh. Now, the other one I'd recommend is Killing Eve. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I want to see it. It's got Sandra Oh, right?
Really good quality British drama. And I'm absolutely loving it. So there is the assassin as such, and there is the detective, and it's the whole lots of sort of mystery and international travel but still grittiness of UK drama. So it's really, I thought it was well worth watching.
Yeah, it's definitely on my list, and so I will because more and more people sort of went through that phase where everyone was watching it, but now you've recommended it again, I'll go back and have a look.
Yeah. Now the other one I watched was a while ago. It was called Exposed, and it's the story of Kelly Lane. And I watched it on ABC iView, as in ABC Australian Television. And it was a good couple of months ago. But Nikki, you, I think, have listened to a podcast on the same subject. Am I right?
Yeah, because you can't be an Australian and have social media presence with Australians in it and not know about this Kelly Lane Exposed situation.
Yes. Maybe if we start by explaining who Kelly Lane is. She's currently in jail because she's charged with the murder of her baby daughter, who she says she handed to its father in the hospital foyer. And the police say, no, she left the hospital with it, and then nobody ever saw the baby again. And where the story gets sort of deeper is that we discover that Kelly Mayne had several pregnancies, a couple that were terminated, a couple that resulted in adoption, and then this one baby that nobody's quite sure of where they went. And why I guess Kelly Mayne is so polarising a figure is she is this blonde girl from the northern beaches who looks like she was raised by a middle-class Aussie family. She was fit and healthy and well-liked by friends and had, you know, people around her who loved her. And you know, at one stage a fairly high-profile boyfriend. And the story just seems so complicated because through these sort of pregnancies she has hidden a lot and therefore lied a lot to hospital staff about what's going on in her life. So I had watched the television series on ABC iView, which went over, I can't remember if it was two or three parts, but it's basically one of those series which would have been a great podcast true crime story, but they did it as a visual. And you see the two journalists who are reporting and investigating, and they're talking to her from the jail each week, where she rings in and does a 6-minute phone call, which is excruciating to listen to because you know that it's on this 6-minute timer and it just cuts out, you know, always right when you've got to some juicy details. I was fascinated by it, and I still, you know, when I think about it now, I'm still so confused about whether she did it or didn't do it or what was involved. What about you?
Well, I was very interested because, as I said, when the case happened, I thought, oh, what an awful person. She's done that and, you know, she was convicted. And I thought, oh, yeah, that all makes sense to me. And then when I've seen a lot of the social media commentary, it's been around, was she really given a fair trial? Was it really investigated properly? Did all these things happen? And when I was listening to the podcast, the thing I was most struck by was the fact that the person who evaluated her case for prosecution, which was Nicholas Cowdery, I believe, he was exactly the same person that evaluated the case that we've talked about here before, the teacher's pet. And he said, in terms of that case, there's no body, there's no witnesses, there's no evidence. So therefore, he didn't see that it was necessary to go ahead and press charges against the person, to her husband, who's considered perhaps the main suspect in terms of the murder of the lady in that story. And in this case, there was no witnesses, there's no body, there's no evidence, but he did push ahead.
Yes.
So in terms of trying her, so it just brought out to me that it seemed to be a little bit of a double standard. Mm-hmm. And because it was a mother killing a child, the thought was there that that happened. Is that why it happened? And because that guy was a famous footballer and a man, is that why he wasn't pushed forward? To me, like, it made me question everything. And the journalist investigating it has said she doesn't really have an opinion on whether she did it or not. She said she's a complicated person. She obviously tells a lot of lies, whether she did or she didn't. I mean, I used to think it would be impossible to hide a pregnancy.
Especially when, in this scenario, this girl's in bathers playing water polo.
Which obviously means that...
What was really sad about that is, because, Nikki, you listened to the podcast No Filter where they interviewed the journalists, right? Caro...
Yeah, just a 1.5-hour podcast.
So you haven't watched the actual series where you get the details, have you? You've just listened to the journalists.
No, I haven't.
Right. So when you watch the series, you see that this girl was a brilliant water polo player, and... what makes it so sad is obviously wearing bathers and being in and out of the pool all the time, there were rumours that started where there were lots of girls saying to each other, oh, you know, do you think she's pregnant? Do you think she's pregnant? But then on top of that, there were lots of adults who obviously did nothing about it, who didn't talk to her about it or her parents or anyone. And I think those people, there was what came out of the television series was there was so much shame where people now look back at it and go, you know, we really did let this, because she was a child at that stage. You know, she was 16 and 7. I think the first pregnancy she was 17, which was terminated. So you just realise this, she was really very lost. And when people say she's a perpetual liar, I could totally see how. Her father was a policeman and her mother was this very strong, strong character, not soft and gentle and not someone you could imagine coming home and telling you were pregnant. Do you know, she was quite fierce. And so when you looked at her scenarios, I could see she would go to the hospital and you could see she just slightly changed details. Like, so say if she lived on Pine Street, she'd say she lived on Vine Street. Or, you know, if the number ended with 23, she'd change it to 24 because she was just trying to protect herself. You know, like she didn't want anyone to find her, to know that she'd got pregnant. Yeah, it really was so interesting and so sad. And yeah, I feel the same way as the journalist, you know, after reading everything and becoming quite consumed by it, you can see how either thing could have happened. You could see how she may have killed the child, but it doesn't make any sense to you because you go, well, she adopted the other two. Why would she choose to, you know, kill this baby when she could have adopted this one as well? But also you just think, well, if the husband and stepmother of this child are out there, why aren't they coming forward?
Yes, and in the podcast they talked about how they might have left the country. So there was someone who knew her from New Zealand from 20 years ago when all this happened, and they had no idea all of this had happened. Mm. So and the other thing that the podcast brought up, which, and as you said, I haven't seen all the details of the TV series, was you know, Lindy Chamberlain.
Yes.
The fact that she was tried and convicted of murdering her baby, and when she had said, in fact, the dingo took my baby, and then years later it was proved correct. So I think that there's just more, look, on the scale of evidence, it's a possibility and a high probability that she may have killed her baby. But I think it's just a fact that it was looked at in a different way.
Yes.
If the case happened now, there would be a lot more things that would be examined.
Yes.
And when the case happened then, there was no, you know, trial by social media or no bathing of light. If a police were conducting an investigation, they conducted the way they always had or the way they wanted to, because no one was questioning what they were doing.
Yes.
Whereas now there's a lot of opportunity for that to be thrown open a lot more. So
yeah.
Look, I think it was fascinating, and I sort of had the impression that I would change my mind about it. Maybe if I watched the TV show, I would, but I didn't necessarily change my mind about what happened, but I understand that it was definitely the whole case was undertaken in a very different way than it would be if it was done today.
And that's been the case with so many of these sort of true crime stories. I mean, we're definitely going through a phase in our generation, aren't we, Nikki, where all these stories are being dug up because they make for such interesting listening and they're incredible entertainment. You know, true crime stories are always in the top, you know, five podcasts that are out, and people can devour them on television. And I think with this one, it's that same thing of the way women were treated, you know, even only 20 years ago. There's been so many things said about Kelly Lane that are so wrong, you know, and she was not given a fair trial in any way because she was seen as this sort of man-eater because of, you know, people's perceptions of her at the time, which...
Right. So the interesting thing that I found from the podcast was that she had a boyfriend, a consistent boyfriend, but they were never the boyfriends were never were never the fathers of the children.
Mm.
So that's another thing. So she was ashamed of
what
she was doing, obviously. And that's why she hid the pregnancy also from her boyfriends. Yes. And yeah, anyway, just a fascinating. I really enjoyed the No Filter podcast that I listened to that Mia Friedman did with the journalist, Caro Meldrum Hanna,
yes,
I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a good tip. Thanks for giving me that tip.
Okay. All right, Nikki, are we done for today?
We're done. Woo-hoo. We're done, done, done. Great chat. Next week, you'll have to tell me about visiting Helen's baby.
I will, for sure. And maybe if she will allow me, we might put a little picture up because he is the cutest baby I have seen in a long, long time. He is beautiful. Okay, I will talk to you next week, Nikki Moffat.
Bye-bye. Bye.